Well, thank you for coming, both of you. I'm sorry there's not more people here. So, really, this carries on from. I think it could be because it's Friday or something, it's 10 o'clock. But anyway, it carries on from last term. So, we're looking at the notion of the importance of religion. And I'm technically going to give three talks, and then Jessica's going to give three following me. So, this one is on this. On The first one is on spirituality and religion, and it's a general extension of what we were looking at last term. But I mean, that's a vast topic. I've got a paper written here on it, but I think I'll probably more generally talk you through this handout that I've prepared, so that we're on the sort of preamble section, I suppose. Now, there's certainly in the modern West and the Atlantic world a decline in traditional religious belief and practice. And this has been mapped by sociologists of religion, such as Steve Bruce's God is Dead. And a good thing, too, he might have added in the title, you know. And others. Jim Beckford has recently written on contemporary religious situation. And another fellow up in Scotland, on religion and the social sciences, who's doing a new book on religion and the contemporary situation. Sorry, his name eludes me right now. So, oh, Richard Roberts, of course, Richard Roberts. So often people in the modern world will define themselves as spiritual but not religious. You often hear that, oh, I'm spiritual but not religious. And this points to a separation between religion and spirituality that didn't happen much before the 20th century. And by this, people tend to mean that they see themselves as being orientated towards some kind of authentic spiritual nature or something, as opposed to and a kind of self-realization, if you like, or experience, in contrast to religion, which they perceive as institutional control against free expression and against sort of authenticity. And Charles Taylor, in the book A Secular Age, has a very useful and interesting discussion of all this, about the breakdown of religion over the last 200 years or so, up to the present time. And he traces the changes in the modern zeitgeist, if you like, and the idea that over the last 30 years or so, the young have been looking for a more direct experience of the sacred. To quote him, greater immediacy, spontaneity, and spiritual depths, end quote, which accompanies a sense of this life being, quote, empty, flat, and devoid of higher purpose, end quote. So this search for authenticity and sacrality Taylor links to Romanticism and its reaction against the disciplined, ordered idea of the self and the modern moral order. He wrote an earlier book called The Sources of the Self, in which he has a chapter called The Punctual Self, in which he describes from Locke the development of the idea of a modern self being being on time and being regulated by the clock and this kind of thing. So this romantic spirituality in the contemporary world, which is decoupled from religious tradition, is a kind of romanticism for Taylor. And it's also linked to the idea of health. It's associated with the search for health. And there's a link in many people's minds between physical and spiritual health, a quest which takes the form of investment in alternative medicine, which reacts against the objectification of the body in mainstream medicine. And Paul Helas up in Lancaster and Linda Woodhead have also mapped out this area, this shift to spirituality. And there's a few books here, Religion in the Modern World, and more recently, The Spiritual Revolution, that Helas and Woodhead compiled. And also Paul Helas's The New Age. It's about 10 years old now. Another book by Wade Ruth called Spiritual Marketplace, which is 1999 actually, he quotes one of his interviewees in there who says, "Well, religion, I feel, is doctrine and tradition, genuflecting, and you have to do things this way. Spirituality is an inner feeling, an allowance of however you perceive it in your world, in your mind, and however it feels is okay. Spirituality is what enters you and lifts you up and moves you to a better person, a more open person. I don't think religion does that. Religion tells you what to do, and when to do it, when to kneel, when to stand up, all of that stuff, lots of rules. So that's probably a fairly typical kind of reaction of many people, that Wayne Roof recalls there. So spirituality, it's thought, emphasizes subjective experience, focuses on the self, and emphasizes feelings, and is privatized. And Paul Hilas and Linda Woodhead describe this as an autonomous exploration, as opposed to surrender to authority. And some have argued that this New Age spirituality is itself driven by market forces and is a kind of late capitalist consumerism. Jeremy Caret and Richard King have written a book, Buying Spirituality. I don't share that scepticism myself. And Richard Roberts has done important work and interesting work on the ways in which spirituality has interfaced with the marketplace, and particularly with managerialism in the 1980s and 90s, and indeed still does so. Perhaps less, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what happens in the economic downturn, whether spirituality is still high on the agenda of some of these corporate concerns. So spirituality has recovered from the social periphery of religious decline because it offers, quote, human renewal, peak experiences, and an enhanced sense of reality, end quote, from Richard Roberts. So management absorbs and enters into this area in offering intense forms of self-realization as both an inducement to and reward for higher performance. And Richard Roberts draws our attention to the parallels here with Weber's Protestant ethic thesis that asserts affinities between the growth of capitalism and this worldly asceticism. But Roberts develops a different kind of argument, beginning with economist Novak. And for Novak, conservative economist, Richard claims that democratic capitalism is characterized by alienation, as Marx said, although alienation from nature rather than from production. And this alienation is the, quote, dark night of the soul, end quote, a wilderness out from which a spirituality can be born. And this spirituality is, quote, the residuum of religion under the conditions of late or advanced capitalism, which can be a source to be exploited and by an empowered elite. Richard Roberts not only maps this territory, but warns us against its dangers and the dangers of management that escapes democratic and social controls. But Roberts is not cynical or sceptical about spirituality and regards it as a genuine, authentic source in modernity, the reconfiguring of the religious field in which people can find a genuine and authentic meaning in an increasingly managerial and alienating world of late modernity. So the general point highlighted by many researchers is that religion in the Western world, especially Christianity, is on the decline. We live in a new spiritual landscape, to quote Taylor's phrase, in which there's a measurable rise in the number of people who state themselves to be atheists, agnostics, or to have no religion. And some people say that they do not believe in God, but rather in an impersonal life force or an impersonal force. Hilas and Woodhead cite a Gallup poll in 1993 saying that in Britain 40% of people believed in some sort of spiritual or life force, as opposed to 30% who had faith in a personal God. I think that's quite high, actually, 30% claim belief in a personal God in Britain. I think it's higher in the States. But alongside this, there's a wide range of beliefs and practices that people often refer to as spirituality. So the picture's complex, but all positions form part of what Taylor calls our expressivist culture. And some people are Catholic but don't accept all of the Church's doctrines, and many people are like that. And some people combine religions, say Christianity with Buddhist meditation. And some adopt religions or parts of religions whose origins are in India or to a lesser extent in China and Japan. Another strong link is between spirituality and therapy, and the idea that spiritual path comprises the self-transformation effected through various techniques or technologies of the self that involves the expression of emotions, the rediscovery of the birth trauma or whatever it is. And again, Hilas has mapped some of these developments, and he calls them self-religions, particularly those that developed in the 1980s. And there's something called EST, I don't know if you've heard of that, or exegesis. This idea of catharsis, that you release these energies within the body and within the self, and that release of tension creates a kind of tranquility or equilibrium. I was just in a film a few couple of weeks ago called The Yes Man. Did you see
I
that?
wanted to see that.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it
what's it?
was really funny. It was a sort of cult of saying everything that happens to you, you say yes to.
I know the gist of it.
And there was a kind of yes guru up there, and so he converts to this kind of new religion. As
Oh, in the meeting house, we got a group called the Yes Group.
Oh, you have?
I didn't realize. Maybe it's got connections with that, I don't know. They're very, very positive and loads of energy, and they bring in outside speakers that are, you know, motivation gurus and people like that. Didn't realize it had that sort of connection.
The film's probably based on reality then, rather than the other way around.
Well, it may be there's some sort of connection. I'll have to find out about that, actually.
Yeah. So every experience happens, you say yes to.
Yeah. Oh, these are very positive people. They're kind of really in your face, you know. It's quite overpowering.
But this got Jim Carrey into all sorts of trouble, you know. Give me all your money, yes. it's very funny. But anyway, so there are many kind of courses like kind of thing that happens up there, and you can go on to Findhorn and go on shamanic journeys and go on weekends of self-realization. And these trends, this move, Taylor calls this the age of authenticity, is a retreat from Christendom, which is, he says, a shattering development in the sense that societies in the West have and will always remain informed by Christianity. So these kinds of new spiritualities mark a distinct shift away from what Taylor calls Christendom. And in reaction to some of these developments, so on the one hand you've got these new spiritualities developing, these new age type spiritualities where you realise yourself, you realise this inner life force, or you have a positive attitude to life, which are fairly body affirming, fairly positive towards the world. And you can change your life and say yes to life and so on. And sometimes there's a reaction against that in the return to scripture and tradition in Judaism and Christianity and Islam. And this is expressed theologically in the clarification of intellectual boundaries between traditions. And I'm thinking of John Milbank's Radical Orthodoxy here, and conservative and liberal Jewish philosophy that reacts to, there's a philosopher called Leo Strauss. And Leonora Batnitsky in the States has written an interesting book on this kind of thing. Julius Gutmann. So these are more conservative kind of reactions. And similar developments occur in Islamic theology, and there's an interesting debate in Turkey at the moment about the integration of Islam with Western modernity, the extent to which that should or should not happen. And at popular levels, not apart from intellectual levels, there are reactions to modernity with the rise of literalist understandings of religion. So you get these fundamentalisms arising, and the Christian right, I think that maybe somewhat toned down now, and then also the rise of Islamic fundamentalisms, or in India the rise of the BJP and these other conservative literalist groups, which you have to see in terms of modernity. But given the decline in organized religion, and given, as I argued last term, that human beings have an aspiration to religion, a quest for meaning, if you like, and intentionality towards meaning and deep engagement with life, then this decline will be and is being replaced by a more amorphous spirituality. So along with Roberts, I do think that the category spirituality has some credence, but I'm more cautious than he, in that contemporary spirituality can turn into a kind of narcissism in which we simply see our own reflection. So on the one hand, admittedly amongst a minority, we have a return to various orthodoxies, a retreat behind the walls of tradition. On the other hand, we have a privatized, amorphous spirituality. With both of these, we're in danger of spiritual life being completely decoupled from any political life, and a fragmentation in which there's no coherent sense of citizenship, let alone of nation. Now, the return to orthodoxy, of course, has a strong political dimension, but it tends to be a reinforcing of cultural and political boundaries at the cost of broader affinities across the body politic. So there tends to be the return to tradition and the kind of raising up the walls of tradition again is often linked to kind of fairly conservative nationalisms. And the return to spirituality has the danger of fragmenting identities, on the other hand, from mainstream political forms. So spirituality in contemporary world has a danger of being not linked to mainstream political concerns and mainstream ideas of citizenship. If religion, once in a Durkheimian manner, provided the glue for social cohesion and for a common civilizational order, to use Taylor's phrase, then the fragmentation into spirituality and the return to a reified tradition means a moving away from such a coherent order. Now, this may or may not be a good thing for the collective body, we don't know. But I do not wish to offer a sort of normative account just yet, but rather a descriptive one. So the first question I want to address really is, what's the relationship between the categories religion and spirituality? And the second related question is, what's the relationship between representation and experience? So representation and experience, how are they connected, which is connected to religion and spirituality? So I wish to transform the first question, the relation between religion and spirituality, into the second question, really, which is the relation between representation and experience. As we saw last term, it's very difficult to define religion. There are substantive definitions which have seen religion as having an essence, such as belief in supernatural beings, and there are functional definitions which seek to demonstrate the place of and function of religion in society, such as Durkheim's definition. And we have family resemblance view that seeks to circumvent problems of both, namely that religions share a range of features, none of which might be shared by all. And this allows us to classify Hinduism and Anglicanism as being in the same category. But even this view needs us to make judgments about what is and is not included in these judgments, and must be based on some pre-understanding of what constitutes religion. For some time, for the time being then, let's follow Charles Taylor in offering a strong sense of religious faith as being defined by the double criterion of, quote, belief in a transcendent reality on the one hand, and the connected aspiration to a transformation which goes beyond the ordinary human flourishing on the other, end quote. So for Charles Taylor, you've got belief in a transcendent reality, and also the belief in that human beings can be changed or transformed in a way that goes beyond what he calls ordinary human flourishing. So for him, ordinary human flourishing is like, you know, leading a fairly successful life, not starving, having a job, having successful relationships with other people. He calls that kind of ordinary human flourishing, which was, and if Freud's aim was to establish that, ordinary human flourishing. But Taylor says, well, that's actually something more to life than that. There's also a transcendence, there's also something which goes beyond, there's a deeper human flourishing which goes beyond the ordinary. And that's what religions are about. Now, spirituality is often associated not so much with belief as with practice. And so you've got if you've got a strong definition of religion like following Taylor, how does spirituality link into that? Well, tradition has been quite closely linked, and it's only recently that it's been separated out. And it's often linked in the sense of spirituality was linked to religion as practice. So Ignatius's spiritual exercises, you think of. And Ignatius opens his text by saying that just as strolling, walking and running are exercises for the body, so are spiritual exercises. So spiritual exercises are the name given to every way of preparing, disposing one's soul to rid itself of disordered attachments. So that's how Ignatius opens the spiritual exercises, where it sounds very sort of Buddhist in a way, disordered attachments. Now, this practical dimension is being emphasized by Pierre Hadot in the ancient world in his Philosophy as a Way of Life. And ancient philosophers talk of therapies of the soul and also the art of living in the Hellenistic world. And ascesis, which form of asceticism comes from that, implies a practical program of training. And Adorno talks about a philosopher called Epictetus, who was concerned with ascesis or asceticism as the art of living, and also another Greek term, prosoke, which is attention or presence of mind and mastery of the passions, kind of an internal transformation in contrast to an evaluating of propositions. Now, if spirituality is practical, then we could say that it's indispensable to religion, that religion is a praxis rather than a set of intellectual propositions, as we were talking about last week. So I mean, to me, religion isn't the heart of religion. It isn't about a sort of set of propositions that you accept, you rationally think about and accept or deny, the way, say, Dawkins tends to view religion as a set of propositions. But it's rather linked in with praxis and a way of life. So what's the definition of religion? You could say it's a way of life. Definition of religion. So it's a praxis rather than intellectual propositions. And the Latin term spiritualitas is a noun derived from the adjective spiritualis, which is a translation of the Greek pneumatikos, which comes into Latin from a translation of the Pauline letters, especially 1 Corinthians 2, 14 to 3, 3. And pneumatikos is from pneuma, which is breath. So originally the word pneuma in Greek meant breath, and it came to mean soul later on, directly parallel to the word atman in Sanskrit, which originally meant breath in the Rig Veda, and comes to mean soul in the Upanishads. So spirit is a breath in a sense originally. So spirituality is linked to breath, and that's an interesting link there. And there's because there's such an emphasis on many spiritual traditions on the breath, on breathing, on focusing on the breath. And Irigaray, an interest, Luce Irigaray, that French feminist, postmodern feminist writer, was very radical feminist, really. But interestingly, you know, a couple of years ago, wrote a book on the breath, and paying attention to the breath. So the breath, if you like, is a link between the lived body, if you like, my body is a lived body, and also a symbolic system or a religious representation or a symbolic body, if you like. So breathing is natural, but it's also cultural as well. Well, we can return to that later on. So the term spirituality then is used in a religious sense, in three senses then. In a religious sense, have I got this? Sorry, I don't have this on the sheet. So it's certainly used in a religious sense, as opposed to life of the body. So there's a spiritual life in contrast to the life of the body in the Latin tradition. So spiritualitas is opposed to carnalitas or animalitas from about the 5th century. And then there's a philosophical sense to designate a mode of being or knowing from the 1st to the 12th century. And you get a judicial sense, which encompasses ecclesial administration of the sacraments. And that's, so their spiritualitas is antithetical to temporalis. All this is from the Encyclopedia de Spiritualité, and the Spiritualité section, which is a really very useful survey. Now, the word spirituality then is used continuously throughout the centuries. In 1429, Jean Gelson uses it to describe the married life between Mary and Joseph. And then right up to the 20th century, von Balthasar has three aspects of spirituality. He says it's opposed to the material world, or a path towards the inner life, towards interiority. As the decision to realize a truth, so the spirit becomes action, and also is apatheia. Apatheia is detachment in Stoicism, or abandonment. In the German mystical tradition, Eckhart, it's Gelassenheit, it's detachment or apatheia. And that apatheia is interesting. So spirituality is linked to apatheia or detachment. It comes from the Desert Fathers. And there's another thinker called Evagrius who brings apatheia into the Western tradition through his student Cassian. And Cassian speaks of a spiritual memory, spiritatis memoria, which refers to a life of prayer, reading, and liturgy. A monastic life is a cultivation of a ductus, of a path, of a channel to an ascetic goal of apatheia or detachment. So there, in traditionally, the word spirituality then is linked very closely to religion and to the doctrines and the practices of a tradition. And it's only in the 20th century that it's become separated out. And on the bus coming in, actually, I was thinking about spirituality is linked to identity somehow, about who you are, a very strong sense of identity. And traditionally, up until now, that identity has been linked to a tradition. So the story of your tradition informs the story of your life. But once the tradition goes, the story of your life is very sort of individualistic and is not linked to the broader tradition anymore. There's Paul Ricoeur's quite useful here on some of this. He has two senses of identity. One is what he calls ipse identity, and one's called idem. And ipse is, they're just Latin, means this. But ipse identity, he refers to narrative identity. It answers the question who. Who you are is narrative, is the story of your life. And that story of your life is often linked to the bigger story of a tradition or the and sense of history, where you are located in history. So the response to the question who is this narrative identity of who you are in history and time, but also who you are in the tradition that you're brought up in, that you're reared in. And often religions are about the conformity, if you like, of your own narrative to the narrative of tradition. And people do this consciously in order to facilitate a transformation in themselves. Idem identity, on the other hand, answers the question what. So you're the same person as you were when you were two, in some sense, but you're also different. But what accounts for the difference is the narrative identity. And in the modern world, there's this idea of spirituality without tradition. So you have this ipse identity formed with a sense of history, yes, but often without a sense of tradition. So you indeed try to decouple yourself from the story of tradition in some ways, in the belief that a spirituality is free-floating and outside of tradition and is individualistic. So that idea, you get two ideas. Well, spirituality within tradition has been the traditional view, but now you've got the idea of spirituality without tradition, spirituality outside of tradition. And that seems to be a very common kind of view these days. Spirituality decoupled from tradition. Now, an interesting example, I wouldn't want to disparage that, but often spirituality is cultivated within traditions and within tradition with strong boundaries like Judaism or whatever. But before we go on to spirituality within tradition, let's look at spirituality without tradition. And a good example here is Simone Weil. So it seems to me that it's an empirical fact that we do have spirituality without tradition. Whether we think this is effective or not is a different question, but clearly we live in a society in which there's a multiplication of spiritual technologies, divorced from traditional ways of life. Now, in an earlier age, spirituality was referred to perhaps as mysticism, which some believed to be at the heart of religions. And traditions were somehow errors that concealed the true heart of religions as this mysticism. Aldous Huxley was partly responsible for this view in his Perennial Philosophy book in 1945, in which he claimed to identify a common vision of mystics across faith traditions, characterized as undifferentiated awareness. But as an example of spirituality without tradition, we can look at the 20th century mystic Simone Weil. I don't know if you're familiar with her at all, but she was Jewish, and she was brought up in France. She was also very highly politically aware, and she was a teacher, and then she became a philosophy teacher. But she was a kind of Marxist, I suppose. But she gave up her teaching career in order to work in factories, in these heavy industry factories. Of course, she had this identification with working people, although she herself was from a kind of respectable middle-class background. And I think
didn't she have an eating disorder and starved herself to death?
That's right. She has various religious experiences, at Assisi and in this monastery called Solem. And she was a philosopher, and she wrote books, and she wrote these great notebooks, very widely read in Indian traditions as well. And then she, when the Nazis invaded, she eventually went to America, and then went to London, where she fought, where she worked for the Free French Association in London. And then she died. She got TB, and she died. And it says on her birth certificate, on her death certificate, sorry, that she died of TB, and through self-starvation. Because she only ate the rations of people in France who were allowed.
Did she get involved in some sort of sect in the Cathars, which were supposed to purify themselves by not getting involved with material things like food?
Yeah, she was interested in the Cathars. Yeah, she was. Yeah. And the bonhommes, the
pure, perfect, yeah.
Perfect, yeah. So, and then there's some people think she had an eating disorder, anorexia, and that she starved herself to death because of that. But it may or may not be the case that she had that anorexia. But it's interesting that, I think, you know, she didn't have to die. Sadly, she did, but she's. Her philosophy, really, she had this idea that you discipline the body, and she has she wrote a number of books. One is Oppression and Liberty, and another one, The Need for Roots, and notebooks. And her life expresses a kind of modern and Western spirituality, I think, divorced from tradition, which is characterized by a longing for experience and expression, and a resistance to formalized religion. So she consistently refused baptism into the Catholic Church under pressure from Father Perrin and various, and somebody, and another one that she was involved in dialoguing with. And she died in Kent at 34, and that she killed herself, the coroner's report said, through refusing to eat, through TB. So she has this asceticism work. Humans desire to improve the condition of their lot, she says, and envisage a utopian future through power, but power becomes its own end and humans become its victims. So she likes work, but there's an ambiguity about work. Work oppresses you on the one hand, and yet it's also a source of going beyond your limits. So she worked in these hard, heavy industries, hard work. She was plagued by terrible headaches and migraines that she writes about. So while she was oppressed by work, it was also a source of liberation for her, and a source of detachment, because you overcome yourself. The self can become empowered through detachment and through refusal to be oppressed by oppression. So she therefore develops a general theory of action. Je puis donc je suis. I can act, therefore I am. Who am I? And she answers that question, what am I is defined by what I can do. I am a being, she says, who exercises this power. And apart from the exercise of power, I am nothing. But I can only act within the boundaries of contingency or chance. I do not have power over my thoughts, but do have power of refusal, which is the power of judgment. So for her, then, spirituality is a kind of intense, personal, subjective experience, which is linked to her sense of power and her sense of refusal to oppression. So the discipline of the body through work is acceptance of time and necessity, but it's also a refusal to be oppressed by time and necessity. And there's a passivity in her work, which she calls waiting for God. You have to wait for God in a kind of passive way. So I think there's a sheet. Did I give you a handout? Let's see when Vey's writings on it. Oh yeah, let's have a look at, this is just from her notebook, on page Let's just look at page 337 then, destruction of the I. This is a common theme in spirituality, that the ego is eradicated for some higher or greater power to be realized. So, destruction of the I. We possess nothing in this world except the power to say I, because fortune can deprive us of everything else in the world, even our character, our intelligence, our loves and our hates, but not the power to say I, unless it be as the result of extreme affliction. There is nothing worse than extreme affliction, which destroys the I from without, for then one is no longer able to destroy it oneself. Only one evil is greater still, and that of having committed a sin against the Holy Spirit. What happens to those whose I has been destroyed from without by affliction? One can only imagine, in their case, a total destruction in the style of the atheistic materialist conception. The fact that they should lose their I does not mean to say that they have cast aside all egoism. On the contrary, certainly this happens sometimes when a dog-like devotion is developed, but at other times the inner being is instead reduced to a state of naked vegetative egoism, an egoism minus the I. However short a time one may have begun the process of destroying the I, it is enough to enable one to prevent any affliction at all from doing one harm, for the I will not allow itself to be destroyed by external pressure without severe struggle. If one refuses to counterbalance such a struggle out of love for God, then the destruction of the I does not take place from without, but from within. So, she wants to destroy the I because that allows you to see God really, but it has to be done, this decreation has to occur within oneself, because the oppression, external oppression, as in capitalism, can destroy you, and that she doesn't think is a good thing. But you can destroy the I from within, and you can also resist oppression through the power of refusal, through the refusal to let that external power crush you. On the page over 127, which is interesting comments on God. About two-thirds of the way down, she's got their cases of true contradictories. God exists, God doesn't exist. Where lies the problem? No uncertainty whatever. I am absolutely certain that there is a God, in the sense that I am absolutely certain that my love is not illusory. I am absolutely certain that there is not a God, in the sense that I'm absolutely certain that there is nothing real which bears a resemblance to what I am able to conceive when I pronounce that name, since I am unable to conceive God. But that thing which I am unable to conceive is not an illusion. This impossibility is more immediately present to me than is the feeling of my own personal existence. So that's quite an interesting and illuminating passage. So Simo Weil, I chose her she's a very rich thinker. She's has a deep sense of spirituality and also a modern sense of spirituality, because for her spirituality is decoupled from organized formal religion. Now, I think she's an exceptional case, but I think that general sense of spirituality decoupled from religion pervades modernity, is what pervades some of these New Age ideas. And also shares the idea of the annihilation of the self. Now, on the other hand, you could say that a genuine spirituality is always linked to tradition. And then I can give various examples. I don't think I'll actually go into this example now, but there's an example from Hinduism I was going to discuss. But anyway, that's a general kind of shape of what I was going to say, what I have said. But in the modern world, spirituality is decoupled from religion, But there are arguably problems in that if spirituality was originally about transformation and a genuine transformation, then if it's decoupled from religion and it's free-floating, then arguably it could be just a kind of narcissism and just a doing what you like without a real transformation occurring. With some exceptions, like Simone Weil, where you do get a genuine kind of spirituality without tradition, in which she is concerned with a deeper kind of change, a deeper transformation of the self. So on the other hand, you could say that actually a genuine spirituality needs tradition, needs to be linked in with tradition, so that the narrative of the self is linked in with the narrative of tradition. So those are just a few ideas. So by way of conclusion, spirituality can be divorced from tradition in late modernity, and indeed is. But we need to probe this descriptive account, and can there be a lasting spirituality without tradition? So which symbolic system do you use? Which language do you use? Can you convey such a spirituality through the generations, or don't you need the shape of tradition in order to do that? Spirituality, you could argue, is intimately tied to tradition, and we can end with the question, can there be religion without spirituality? Well, I guess the answer to that is yes, but can it last? Well, when it becomes that, you often get responses within tradition. The history of religions are often, religions become a bit ossified, a bit dry, a bit lacking spirit, and then you get reactions against that. You get reform movements and so on, which again emphasize this more immediate connection with a transcendent force or whatever. So those are some of the ideas that I thought I'd share with you. It's not thought about this, and it's not a proper argument yet, but it's still on the way to becoming. So do you think spirituality is a useful category?
Yeah, I do, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've just been doing Dirt Cards. It's very interesting to just to conceive of that move towards individuality.
Yeah.
But no, I think...
That's right. I mean, the Durkheimian model seems to break... I mean, where religion is a social glue of a community, the sacred is a social glue, that's kind of broken down, I think.
Very much so.
But in the West.
And I guess you could say it goes in cycles, like you said. We're moving towards individualism, but gradually... Because that might fail, it might go back again.
Yeah.
In time.
Yeah. It might well do. Yeah. It's interesting, though, that the predictions of some of the sociologists of religion and so on haven't come true. You know, that religion hasn't died away, and it reconfigures itself in different ways in our culture and society. Mm. So, one suspects that there's a religious impulse within human beings.
What you said as well about the literalist interpretations of scripture or whatever, and fundamentalism as a reaction to modernity.
Mm.
I mean, is that kind of to be conceived in a sociological way, in the sense of spiritualism is pervasive, so we react with our doctrine, or could that also be just a reaction against sort of liberal scholarship and biblical criticism
of
scripture?
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, I think intellectually it is.
Intellectually, actually. I suppose it works on two levels, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it works on two levels. Yeah, I think you've got a popular kind of return to literalism or fundamentalism and so on, which are a reaction to feeling threatened by modernity.
Yeah, popular and intellectual.
Yeah, and then you've got this intellectual level, which is again, very much a reaction against liberal scholarship, self-consciously a reaction against liberal scholarship. Mm. So you've got, I think part of it is conservative theology. Well, Lynn Beck, in 20 years ago in the States, and Howard Wask, I mean, highly articulate, intelligent characters, but and indeed John Milbank, radical orthodoxy in Christianity. which are movements against liberal theology, attempt to retrieve tradition, which are very interesting movements. And
I guess the two correlate as well. Because, I mean, if you've got this intellectual kind of debate going on about, just to use an example, the 7-day creation, as soon as you start to get biblical criticism about mythology and how it's a myth, and you know, and then you get the reaction to say, well, no, it's literal, it's the word of God. I guess that feeds the popular movement as well.
Yeah.
As soon as this kind of intellectual advancement is echoed, perhaps in the followings.
I think that's right. And it's happened for 100 years.
Yeah.
When Strauss, was it? Was it? What Leo Strauss? I can't remember his first name. But anyway, in the 19th century, he wrote that book, The Historical Jesus or something. Mm. And after. And that, you know, introduced kind of his biblical criticism of the New Testament and so on. And the debate's been raging ever since.
This decoupling of spirituality and religion, it seems to be, as you were talking about it, I was thinking, well, this is a, seems to be a very sort of Western phenomenon.
Mm.
And then after was Sufism, which also seemed to be a reaction against authoritarian Islam.
Yeah.
Not sure about that. But then I was thinking, well, if it was Western, then why is it? And why is it particularly kind of a modern, recent phenomenon, relatively? And maybe it's a reaction against secular substitutes of religion, like totalitarian ideology, which have been manifestly failed on a, you know, sort of massive grand scale. And you know, I think there's been probably a post-war reaction against that. People are looking for something more authentic rather than authoritarian and dictatorial.
That's right. I think that's right. I mean, Charles Taylor more or less says what you just said there in his book. Yeah, I agree. Right. Yeah. That looks like it. I mean, all these big ideological movements of the 20th century, you know, fascisms and communisms and totalitarian claims, people had enough of, really.
Well, they failed like grand scale, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, they adopted religion as
got all the trappings of religions, and they got the social control mechanisms as well.
It's very interesting, I think, that when you look at societies under dictatorships, the only thing they can never seem to really cancel out is some sort of religion. Like even with Stalin, you look at the people, and I don't know much about it, but the fact that religion is still pervasive underneath all of that, that they can't quite get rid of.
That's right, yeah. Or China, Maoism. Buddhism bubbles up to the surface again, or Confucianism. Yeah, that's very interesting. That massive power is concertedly used in the service of getting rid of religion, and it still hasn't worked. It's interesting. It still resists that.
Yeah, I think there is a basic, almost biological drive.
Yeah,
for some. And I was thinking that in connection with what you were talking about with breathing. And I've been thinking about this in another connection, but I was thinking about the way that breath can link different levels of our consciousness. Maybe in terms of, I think there are some yogic breathings, for instance, which involve hyperventilation and sort of supersaturation of oxidation of the brain. I'm sure that affects brain function.
Mm.
And then breathe carbon dioxide, they reduce their breathing in order to produce another kind of psychological effect.
Calm the breath, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know, stimulate hormone output and all this. I think there's the sort of levels of chemistry that we're only just discovering which can affect our, I don't know, states of consciousness.
I'm sure that's right, yeah. But those chemical reactions and so on are often understood in traditional ways, you know, people have can account of what they're doing.
They've often got their own language because I don't think we understand the mechanisms in the, you know, more mechanistic, materialistic sense.
Yeah. So that when the yogis are doing their breathing and calming their breath and so on, that might well be what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can kind of shut down pain receptors and lie on beds and nails and things like that, and even subvert the sense of gravity, so you've got this sense of levitation. I mean, I don't think you actually you know, do rise from the ground, but you certainly get that sensation of it under certain circumstances. Takes a lot of discipline and working on, but it's amazing.
It's part of initiation rites as well, isn't it? Yeah. There are kind of tribes and cults where, you know, coming of age, you have to go and kind of do all these things.
That's right.
Yeah. I think this kind of links in with sort of fairly recent, you know, the drug culture and things like that, and people experimenting with chemicals and all different cultures where, you know, Mexican Indians and things like that, where they, and shamans eating mushrooms. I think there's a lot of kind of sort of basic biology and chemistry underlying, and maybe that keys in something very, very fundamental.
Yeah, I think that's right. But all these things are always linked in with the traditional explanations and traditional accounts, which I think is important.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, go on.
Oh, I don't want to keep us all here, but one other thing that's very interesting that struck me, and that was. Here we are. Simone Weil, and she's talking about self, and hang on a minute, just try to get my notes here.
What, in this passage?
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in why. I can't see where I've written it down. I think it's kind of. Sorry, it's. About this sense of self, really, which is what she's investigating, it seems to me, internally. There are certain psychiatric disorders where the sense of self is damaged or even lacking. And I think those people have got, I know this for a fact, gravitation towards religion and looking for a sense of self in that way.
Right. So because they don't have a sense of self, they seek to create one or through tradition.
Yeah, and borrowing it in a kind of a group experience in a way. There's certain personality disorders where that is the case.
It's like Dirk Hahn's collective effervescence, the idea of when you're in a group you can kind of rise above the self.
Identify with others,
And then that affirms society.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
And there must be analogues to that in contemporary society.
Definitely. Mm. Some sort of religious festivals and things like that. People gathering, it's like a state of euphoria almost.
Pop festival, I suppose. Football. Yeah.
Football crowd.
Well, thanks for coming, everyone.